Last lecture, I computed something. It was a bit painful, but I promise I'm not going to do any calculation again. But, let me just recap what I did. I told you that really there is a very simple formula. You don't need to know the Boltzmann equation. I give you a simplified derivation which arrives at the same result just by integrating the geodesic equation. All I did in the last lecture was integrate the geodesic equation. Okay? And you end up with this result, you find a temperature fluctuation in a given direction n is a combination of your Doppler effect. So remember, initial and final means last scattering emission and final as in us receiving the photon. So there's a Doppler effect. Then there is a series of terms describing fluctuations in the last scattering surface. One of them is the potential. If you're on the top of a hill, you'll see something bluer. The other one is the intrinsic density fluctuation. If something is hotter, you will see it hotter, of course, but it started off hotter. And finally, there is a Doppler effect as well, because the things which last scattered, the photons could be moving towards us as well. So a word of warning, there's already been a statement about cosmologists having to work with them, string theorists having to work with them. Cosmologists hold baryons to anything that's normal matter. So an electron is a baryon as far as a cosmologist is concerned, which is obviously wrong. But most of the normal matter is baryonic, is protons, okay, and neutrons. So although the thing which last scattered the photon was actually an electron by a constant scattering, the electron is actually in the frame of the baryons anyway. So you call this VB, or it's VE. So it's one of these eccentricities of terminology, but anyway. So this is the fluctuations on the last scattering surface, and then there is a very unusual term which people normally have not seen, and which pertains to non-conservative fields, fields which are changing in time. And in this case, phi dot plus psi dot is called integrated Sachs-Wolfe term if you have scalars. If you have a tensor component, and I explained what the tensor scalar vector decomposition were, then you get an extra term, which is ni and j, hij, where this is the tt bit of the metric dot, and this is also a contribution to the integrated Sachs-Wolfe. So there's some physics in all of these things. Of course, a gravitational wave is a non-conservative field. It's varying, it's oscillating. So it's going to have an integrated Sachs-Wolfe. It's not just a difference in potential beginning and the end. These terms, I told you, there's a bit of an ambiguity about what you call psi and delta. I warned you about something called the gauge problem, which is really how you slice the universe into equal time surfaces if the thing is perturbed. As I said, sometimes you put terms pertaining here, there, and vice versa. You don't worry about it too much. Incidentally, well, I'll tell you this later, but what I computed last time was this bit here, so the plateau. You see the plateau here is bundled together with a thing that eventually oscillates, which is the radiation. So it's an example of bundling together these two terms. Sometimes you do, because particularly outside the horizon, you have all these gauge ambiguities, and sometimes you have to put things together to help them to engage in variance. Okay, and then I computed the term that resulted from this. As I said, this plateau really is a direct measurement of the pristine and processed initial conditions in the potential. And it was a bit of like fireworks with Bessel functions and so on, but anyway, I ended up finally with this thing that CL is proportional. Proportional because I've been throwing away factors of pi and things like that. Essentially, I kept everything that gave me the right spectrum, but not the amplitude. And then I have dk, k squared. Then I have the power spectrum in phi. So I said that there really are two scalar potentials, phi and psi, but they're the same as long as no viscosity. That's one of the Einstein equations. So I have the power spectrum, which is the thing I want to measure. But what actually I see is the C sub L. The projector is this Bessel function square. So this was a bit of an unpleasant calculation, but eventually this gives you some kind of amplitude times L plus 1. Which is the reason why you plot things with CL times L times L plus 1. So if you have scale invariance in the initial conditions, that's really what you get in the end, something which is flat in L times L plus 1 times CL. Okay, so this is a summary of what I did. Actually, I did the calculations. As I said, I didn't do the full calculation, which would be to integrate the Boltzmann equation. I did a simplified calculation, which gives the same result, effectively. And then, well, I didn't finish. I gave you some films. What happened? Okay, it's there again. I didn't actually finish doing the calculation in the sense that, and I won't be doing the full thing, but what I said is, what that formula gives you is essentially what happens during this phase of free streaming. So we're here, we observe the last scattering surface. There are fluctuations here, which give you, obviously, the integrated Sachs bulk. There are fluctuations here, which give you those three terms. And the question is, where did these fluctuations come from? Obviously, inflation didn't start at 300,000 years. Inflation was much earlier. So whenever you have any kind of spectrum, which is initial, primordial, I still need to propagate that up to the period of last scattering. And that really doesn't affect things outside the horizon, because they remain untouched. But things which are inside the horizon, and I already explained the scale of these peaks, is the scale of the horizon of last scattering. So those things which enter the horizon before last scattering, they will be processed by this phase, which I call tight coupling. So I promise I won't be doing any other full calculation. What I'm going to be doing now is a sketch of what actually happens. But if you have a perfect fluid, which is your assumption here, which only has photons, you end up with two equations. One is the Euler equation, so the density contrast in the radiation has an equation which is like this. So this is basically the time derivative in the energy density. This is the divergence in the velocity. This is the potential. And probably recognize this as a continuity equation. And then if you have something else which gives you the acceleration for the Euler equation, you say the velocity dot plus 1/4 delta plus k phi equals 0. This is the Euler equation, which basically tells you that force equals mass times acceleration. This is the acceleration. This is the gradient of the pressure. The pressure is proportional to delta. So as a result, from the gradient, I get the k. This is the gradient. But this is the gravitational force, the pressure force. And this is what you get. Of course, you still need another equation, which is the Poisson equation. And that's k squared. It's basically telling you what generates the potential. And you end up with something which is 4 pi a squared rho delta gamma plus 4 a dot over a 1 over k mega. So you can actually solve these things exactly. And surprisingly, you're going to get further Bessel function, things like that. I'm not going to be doing that. What I'll be doing now is essentially noticing that this equation is something like very roughly, something like this. So the k horizon is the k corresponding to the horizon at a given time. I look at the expansion of the universe, I define the length scale corresponding to that expansion scale. So k's which are bigger than these given k horizon mean smaller modes, mean things inside the horizon. K's which are smaller means things outside the horizon. Remember, k is inverse length. So if you're inside the horizon, one thing you find is that the potentials can be neglected in these equations. In other words, you really need to go outside the horizon to be gravity driven. And this has an incredible effect, which is I can simplify those equations enormously. So if I throw away potential terms, I end up with a free oscillator, which is the thing that gives you the acoustic oscillations, okay? So what I get is delta gamma dot minus 4/3 k v gamma and I get a vegan add-on, which is minus 1/4, okay, of the gamma equals 0. So this is just a simple harmonic oscillator with some funny restoration force. Combine these two things, you can actually get delta gamma squared plus k squared over 3 equals 0. This is the frequency. And you can find, normally the frequency is the speed of sound times k. Basically, you find the speed of sound is 1 over square root of 3. So the speed of sound in radiation is 1 over square root of 3 of the speed of light. It's about half the speed of light. And that's essentially what happens. If I have a radiation in tight coupling regime as a fluid, the thing is concentrated. There will be more pressure, so the thing goes out. The thing is diluted. There will be less pressure, the thing goes in. And you just set up these oscillations. Acoustic oscillations, because the density waves. And the speed of these waves is about half the speed of light. Okay, so this is the explanation of the rest of the terms that come up there. What you find is there are going to be two types of waves. There's going to be cos waves and sine waves. So there's going to be, like, in fact, some number here, which we ignore. The velocity and the density contrast are going to be out of phase. As usual in the harmonic oscillator, the velocity and the actual distance from the equilibrium point are out of phase. One is a cos, one is a sine. And why is this a cos? Well, because outside the horizon, this thing actually has a value. So if you get the right initial position, I need to have a cos wave there. So there are two types of modes. You probably have heard about these. There's adiabatic modes, isocurvature modes. I don't want to go into that, but basically that propagates into whether these things are sines or coses. So there are two types of modes here. I could write the most general solution. This corresponds to two types of initial conditions. Most inflationary models produce only the adiabatic mode, which is the one I'm writing down here. But what you find is that when k is of the order of k horizon, which is when this calculation starts being valid, you find that phi is of the order of delta. Because that factor, which relates to the two, is the k horizon divided by k, everything squared. So whatever primordial power spectrum I have here propagates to the power spectrum in the density of the photons as they enter the horizon, as the mode enters the horizon, which is my initial condition. Yeah? So I can use the Harrison-Zeldovich initial condition to set up the initial condition for delta as it enters the horizon. So at the horizon crossing, what you find is that this is also true. Where this thing here means at the horizon crossing. And this is exactly what I need to set up this initial condition here. Okay? So this is really what you need to plug in here. So what I said you should be doing is the same calculation I did last time for the sine. You know, you have to do it with these guys, it's more complicated. But basically what you need to do is have a power spectrum now for this guy, the delta, with a Bessel function, which is a projector. The rest of the calculation is the same. Okay? So the only thing is that instead of having a power law here, I'm going to have something which is like 1 over k cubed times a sine wave. So the thing which, if this was just 1 over a cube, I would get something flat. And surprising what I get is something which is flat times an oscillation, which is the reason for these things called Doppler peaks. Okay? So there's no way to do the calculation exactly at this point, unless you do further approximations. But that's essentially what you need to do. You need to plug in here the power spectrum of delta, which is going to be a 1 over a cube for this reason. I explained here, sorry, this is a cube here. You get the 1 over k cubed from squaring this guy there, and then you have a cos square in there. And you evaluate this at last scattering, just like you did before. So this potential was also at last scattering. And in this case, you evaluate delta as at last scattering. So you have two kinds of waves. You have waves in time, the things that are oscillating in time. But if you look at a given snapshot of a given time, you have waves in k as well, because they arrive at this time in different phases. Because we have different multiplication factors. And this is the reason why you end up with oscillations in K, and eventually the oscillations in L. Although the projector between K and L, as I said, is not really very sharp. But that's basically a sketch of full calculation. Any questions about this?
What causes the noise in K?
It's the pressure. So it's essentially the fact that you have a restoration force, which is the pressure. So if you have a gradient of pressure, if you have some, it's the usual, it's the same thing which causes sound. I'm talking to you, right? So that it's exactly the same thing. So every time I have a compression in a given region, the pressure is bigger. So this thing tends to flow out. And every time I have an underdensity, the pressure is bigger inward, so things tend to flow in. So as a result, what happens is that I have a situation in which you oscillate between rarefaction and compression, just like in a sound wave, except this is it's a density wave in a fluid which is relativistic. It's anything that's different. Instead of having oxygen and whatever, I have photons, thermalized photons. Anything else? So physically, that's really what is behind all this. The rest is just formulated. Physically, that's what's going on. Okay, so first surprise, people call these oscillations, as I said right in the beginning, this thing is called the plateau, this thing is called the Doppler peaks. So you might have thought they resulted from the Doppler effect. It's a misnomer, it's not. It's a density peaks. So then back in 92, when people didn't know anything about these, a group of us tried to change the terminology, and we failed miserably. But people still thought we measure these things by Doppler peaks. In fact, your acoustic oscillations. The Doppler effect is actually completely subdominant. So the Doppler term, I printed it here, it's in blue. It's out of phase with the acoustic oscillations, as you would predict. So one is a cos wave, one is a sine wave. So when you project these into L, actually, if anything, what the Doppler effect, what this term is doing, is actually filling in the valleys of the acoustic oscillations. And what you find in here is not as sharp as it should be because of the Doppler effect. And anyway, it's out of phase with the Doppler effect, what you observe. The dominant term is actually the acoustic oscillation. And this is physically what is going on. So in this picture, free streaming of things from last scattering surface outside the horizon gives you the plateau. The acoustic oscillations give you all this stuff. This is the density, this is the velocity. And this is an extra integrated Sachs bulb I won't go into. And this is the big picture. And now the question is, I showed you these various films at the end of last lecture. And I can measure all these cosmological parameters by looking at the position of these peaks. The question is why. So let me just give you a sketch of the reason why. There's very good reasons for it, but maybe what I should do is put the film at the end. So the thing which is probably most sensitive in this whole calculation is, if I can find it, is the curvature of the universe. So this is a picture which starts with a very closed universe. It goes into a flat universe and then goes into a very open universe. So the reason why people say, oh, we can measure the curvature of the universe with percent is exactly because the position of this first peak depends very, very crucially on the geometry of the universe. All the calculations I've done so far were actually done in a flat universe. This Bessel function resulted from expanding plane waves, i.e. flat universe, into spherical harmonics. So I'm not going to show you what the expansion is. It's a really horrible function and so on. But physically, what is going on here is, so omega k, or omega, the full omega. What the microwave background is doing is giving you a ruler at the last scattering surface, which is these acoustic oscillations. I mean, I know the period of these waves, I know the wavelength of these waves, I know the horizon scale of these waves, okay? So I know their proper distance. And the question is, how does this transfer into an angular distance? Well, there's something else I know. I also know the distance to the last scattering surface because I know what the redshift is for the hydrogen to recombine, for the photons to decouple. So I have a problem of solving a triangle. Okay? So I have this distance here, and I have this distance there. And of course, if I have a flat geometry, all I need to do is just find this angle. It's very simple. But if I were in a sphere, for example, then what happens is that these geodesics converge, actually. So the same kind of picture would result in an angle which should be much larger. It would be something more like this. So there would be an extra bit of angle in this triangle. And the bigger angle, well, that means a smaller L. L is inverse angle. So this means all these peaks, for example, the first one, will be shifted to the left if I have a closed universe. If I have an open universe, it's exactly the opposite. So if I have these hyperspherical things, then actually what happens is that the geodesics will be more like this. And what I will have instead is a smaller angle, therefore a higher L for all this system of peaks. So to actually measure the omega of the universe, in fact, I don't need all the 3, 4, 5, 6 peaks. The first one is enough to start giving me a good result. And eventually, people hope to measure omega to about 1% because of this gain. Okay? The ascended degeneracies, namely with the cosmological constant, I can actually make the relation between the redshift and distance change. And I can play with the cosmological constant and the curvature to actually end up with the same exactly the same system of peaks. This is called the degeneracies. So the ascended degeneracies, particularly in this case with omega lambda, but they can be resolved by appealing to other data sets. We know about the cosmological constant. Why? Because of supernovae results. There's this whole thing about doing the Hubble diagram to try and measure the acceleration of the universe, etc., etc. Well, if I appeal to these other data, then I remove the degeneracies. And basically, this picture is correct. So this is one example of why rising that these films give you, in the end, such a sharp dependence on cosmological parameters. Let me give you another one. So this one would result. This is what happens if I want to measure how much of the universe is maybe normal stuff, you know, omega variable. So in this case, one thing I've been neglecting throughout in this approximation is the effect of the variance before last cut. So I didn't actually do the calculation. Let me tell you the result. If I were to do the tight coupling a bit more rigorously, what happens is that it's a bit like having a pendulum oscillating within a gravitational field. So you know what happens is that essentially you shift the zero point, or like a spring of the pendulum, the spring going up and down. Suppose I have a spring. And this thing just oscillates. Suppose I put this in a gravitational field. The thing just goes down, has exactly the same amplitude. So I should say the same frequency. But the zero point is shifted up to account for these extra gravity forces. So what the variance do is they provide an extra term, which can never be neglected even inside the right in this equation. So it's a bit like an oscillator with a force applied to it, which is a constant force. And the effect is, well, in the case of no baryons, I just have these oscillations. If I have baryons, then these oscillations are going to be shifted, and I end up with something like this. So this is the effect of omega baryon on the photon, if I just have oscillations with this extra condition of having more baryons. So this is increasing omega b. Now what I do is I square these. What I'm essentially doing, sorry, I did something wrong. This is a sine wave, cos wave, sorry. So I should have started there. So when I square this thing, what I get is, usually I get a system of peaks like this. So this is still part of the plateau, first peak, second peak, third peak, etc. If I do the same thing here, what I get is big, small, etc. So what the baryons do is they introduce an asymmetry between the even peaks and the odd peaks. When you actually look at the microwave background, that's what's happening. If I increase the omega baryon ridiculously, other effects come into play. But as long as I'm reasonable, essentially, the effect this has on the oscillations is having things like these. Instead of just going all the way down, you have an effect which is basically, you enhance the peaks, which are the odd peaks. OK, so we'll be going through this. One thing I mentioned earlier on, which is actually not mentioned completely in this calculation, is the effect, for example, of reionization. If you rescatter the photons, i.e. if there is a reionization which is sufficiently early that the photons rescatter, well, what happens is that you're going to type coupling, not quite, but you're going to something like type coupling again, and you smooth out everything, all the fluctuations. So if the universe really reionizes a bit too soon, there will be a bit of a disaster in terms of these fluctuations, and therefore we get a constraint on the ionization history of the universe. So it was neutral by redshift 1000. It's clearly ionized again by redshift of 5 or 3 or something like that. Nowadays it is ionized. The question is, when did it become reionized? It cannot have been too early, otherwise you get rid of all the things. And et cetera, et cetera. Basically, all these, the game people play in this area is essentially trying to, together with at least polarization, classical structure, supernova results, and these things, they try to see how all these parameters are encoded into the observations, and therefore estimate these things the best you can. So someone already mentioned, I've been ignoring tensor modes. So the tensor modes are these integrated Sachs-Wolf. I promise not to give you more Bessel functions, so I didn't compute it. But that's essentially what you're doing. If we have gravitational waves, what you're doing here is basically bumping this plateau, making it bigger. And this is very difficult to observe. Okay, so the level of gravitational waves you predict, for example, from inflation is so small that you never see it here. Something which might be interesting, though, is polarization, which is something I'll talk about in a bit. And so on. So any questions about this? I'm going to be moving to polarization, which is the last topic of this course. So I have to give you a problem. I don't know exactly what the problem is going to be, but one of them could be actually to do this calculation a bit more rigorously. For example, try to explain what the baryons are doing to this system and why do you get these effects. I think I have a better one later on, polarization. That's an idea. Okay, let me move on to the last topic then. So by the way, before I move into that, so maybe this is a better picture for what happens when you go from first year to third year. As you can see, the problem has been really digging into the beam and trying to pin down this third peak. So the first year map, the first year WMAP data pinned on this peak, first one very well, the second one very well, the third one was not very good. You had these big error bars, and then they grow exponentially, and you stop bothering to plot this. So with the third year data, what you manage to do is actually pin down the third peak. And what happens is, of course, you can pin down things like omega baryon much better. It's not just fixing cosmological parameters. As I said, when you go to cosmological parameters, that means a level of prejudice. But if you don't have that prejudice, then you still have like use for these things. And for example, someone asked me, what about fundamental physics? What can we learn from fundamental physics? Well, generating the primordial spectrum is already fundamental physics. But every now and then, I play this game, I don't like dark matter.
So what if we never seen dark matter? Can we actually do cosmology without dark matter, but modifying the theory of gravity? You may think it's a nicer, it's more, you know, it's intrinsically more consistent thing to do. It's actually a nightmare to do that. And if you try to do, for example, modified gravity, which essentially looks at, for example, the rotation curves of galaxies as Kepler's laws for a new theory of gravity, and you just do not paint the universe with dark matter where we need it to make relativity work. If you play that game, one thing that happens is that it's very difficult to actually predict the first thing. So if you don't like dark matter and you say fundamentally gravity is different, you can actually kill that option. Not totally, but it looks like it's quite difficult to do anything like that because of this third peak. In general, this thing just goes down. And basically, you can see why this might be the case because of forming a baryon. So this is essentially the dark baryons that are pushing this peak up.
We say in the IGRT, you don't need only for spectrum size, you need also on the full metric, RW metric, mm-hmm. you need every peak, right?
No, I mean the dynamics thing. So suppose that I say, okay, so if you know what the problem is, basically you have rotation curves that flatten out.
Yes.
And they shouldn't flatten out because it's just Newtonian dynamics.
Exactly.
If they flatten out because gravity is a bit different from what you thought, you define a new theory of gravity that explains the observations without dark matter.
Exactly, but I mean that they don't only explain the rotation curve of the galaxy. I mean, when people start to do this calculation, then from the beginning, when they write Einstein equation, it's simple Einstein equation, they use this, for example, one equation.
Yeah,
right. From the beginning. Is that what we are doing?
So the big problem is that it's not enough. You need a relativistic version of
exactly,
this theory.
Yes.
And you have to do that first.
Exactly.
So once you have that, then you basically have to find the Einstein equations for the universe, the perturbed Einstein equations for this theory, and so on. And this is what happens. You have trouble with the third peak. You can't fit the third peak, but you have to bend backwards. And God knows what happens with the fourth peak. So probably wouldn't be able to fit it. So in other words, this is the discriminity. So it's not just, you know, I can fudge baryons with gravity. At some point, they're intrinsically different. Dark baryons and this theory, they are intrinsically different. And by pinning down these peaks, you will don't need it. Which I think is pretty fundamental. When you think about quantizing gravity, well, if classical gravity is wrong, it's not what we think it is, and we've been quantizing the wrong theories, this could be completely different. But it doesn't look like it's the case. So every time I've worked on these alternative theories, like a few months later, I get depressed, and I work on dark matter again. And the reason is much easier. At the end of the day, it's much easier to fit the data in a simple, minimal way, with particles we've never seen. Maybe wrong. Yeah, but it's the way it is. Okay, let me move on then to polarization, which is the last topic. Polarization is difficult. It's a difficult topic. And the reason is that all these approximations are really not completely, correct, and basically they throw away a lot of stuff. I've been using tight coupling, free streaming and tight coupling, and then gluing the two, and the question is what happens in between those two regimes. It's never a sharp transition. So one thing that comes out of this is that silk damping fail, I've been mentioning it. Nothing in the calculation I've done tells you why these peaks go down. On the contrary, they should just keep going. In fact, they go down because of diffusion. There's diffusion, there's a point in which things are not tightly coupled, they're not free spinning yet. And the other thing that happens here in this transition is polarization. And this happens because, in both cases, as diffusion or as viscosity, things don't behave exactly like a perfect fluid. And this is exactly when you generate these effects. So there's no way to actually derive these effects without the full calculation, which I'm not going to do. I'm going to sketch what is needed. So what you need to do in general is actually solve the Boltzmann equation, which, as you know, is not a very easy thing, but essentially some kind of total derivative in phase space equals a collision integral, where this f is a distribution function. So in general, f is a function of x, p, and of t. And if things have a thermal spectrum, and they remain thermalized, which has been an assumption throughout, and I've shown you the pictures, but the CMB is really, really well formalized. I can write these in this format. So essentially, this is the delta T over T. Things remain thermal. The only thing you need to change is the temperature. And you call this thing the brightness factor. So this is how, in a very sketchy way, you integrate the Boltzmann equation. What you do is you get this guy, this delta. You expand it in Fourier modes. And then this is the direction of P with respect to x. So it's basically k dot the direction of k times the direction of the p. So we have a Fourier mode which describes the dependency in x, but then you also have a dependency in p, and that projects into it. So you can expand that into Legendre polynomial. So essentially, you have something which is azimuthal, symmetric. And this is what you look at, these multiples of the brightness function, which indeed become the CLs. So the C sub Ls can be more easily written as a function of these theta Ls. Except that the Boltzmann equation is quite complicated. So what you have from here is a huge hierarchy of ordinary differential equations, which I'm not going to write, but basically you start with 0, with 1, with 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. In these equations, we have the collision integral. So constant scattering is going to be very important. Thing, and it's going to be exactly the thing that distinguishes between tight coupling and free streaming. A very important parameter which appears here are terms which depend on something called tau dot, which is the number of collisions you have on average for expansion time. So this is the number of electrons, targets, Thomson's cross section, or Compton's cross section, and the expansion factor of the universe. And then you look into the regimes. You look into the regime where this thing goes to zero and where this thing goes to infinity. And this is exactly what determines tight coupling and free streaming. So I don't get anything new with respect to what I've done. If I use this calculation, I get the formula I derived last time. If I use this limit, then I get exactly the equations I've been writing in this lecture. With the following things, the following notes that the delta gamma I've been writing is the monopole, so it's the L equals zero of the brightness function, it's not very surprising. The velocity of the photons is 3 theta 1, which is the dipole of the brightness function. And then I didn't write it, but if I have a fluid with viscosity, the viscosity is actually the theta 2. Etc. Okay. So in these two regimes, this guy is actually zero. I get the same equations with these identifications from the Boltzmann equation in this regime. In the other regime, I get the formula, that huge formula derived by integrating the geodesic equation. So I could do it here. What I get in addition is basically an intermediate regime. Okay. An intermediate regime is the regime in which, well, there's going to be, the thing is not a perfect fluid, there's more than a velocity, and the density is viscosity. As a quadrupole, okay, this is what this thing is, the brightness function as a quadrupole. And this is essential for polarization. Okay, so this is the main reason why I'm telling you this. You really need to go beyond this approximation to understand silk damping, for example, or to understand polarization. So this is how you do the calculation exactly. You put this on a computer, obviously. You end up with like 1,000 or 2,000 of these coupled together. You're not going to do that by hand. But really, the only reason why you need it is to have the intermediate regime pinned down. And why you do it is mainly because I want silk damping, I want polarization. Okay, basics of polarization. Obviously, I'm not going to do the calculation, but I'm going to tell you what is at stake. Just not sure it is yet. Basics of polarization. When do things become polarized? Things become polarized by reflection. So if I have light which isn't polarized, and I reflect it over something, it becomes polarized, linearly polarized.
So reflection means what? Means scattering. So you can see that there's only a chance of producing polarization when I scatter the photon. So I need to be in a phase which is not yet free streaming to get polarization. So very, very basically, essentially, this is the physical process. If you have like X, Y, and Z, make sure we know what we're talking about. Suppose I have a light ray that goes in the X direction. Well, as you know, this thing is, if I look at the plane orthogonal to it, polarization must be on this plane. And if I have unpolarized light, if I look at rays which are slightly to one side or the other, or slightly different frequencies, they end up with random polarization. So incoherent light doesn't have a well-defined linear polarization. But then what happens with reflection is that every time I hit something, suppose there's an electron here, suppose I go with incoherent light, suppose I scatter and I go in the opposite direction, then what happens is that I preserve the polarization, but all the polarizations, which would become longitudinal with respect to the new direction of motion, are obliterated completely. And this is because of gauge invariance. So you cannot have longitudinal polarization in photons. What happens is that every time you scatter, everything is conserved, which is not inconsistent with longitudinal polarization. So if I go in this direction, so in this case I had X, I had Z and Y polarizations. So the Y polarization would be longitudinal. So I just preserve the Z polarization. And I end up with light linearly polarized along the Z if I scatter in the Y direction. Okay? It would be exactly the opposite if I go into the Z direction. Well, there's a Z and there's a Y. The Z would become longitudinal. So I become linearly polarized, in this case, in the Y direction. Okay? So this is the physical process, really, that you're doing here. Every time you scatter things, even if the light initially wasn't polarized, it becomes polarized, because you have to eliminate all the degrees of freedom in the polarization, which would become longitudinal. So this is interesting. Another question is, what happens if I have unpolarized light and I scatter it over something? But what if light comes from everywhere? What exactly happens? So this is the game you're playing here. And the second thing I want you to think about is what happens with isotropic radiation. So in this case, suppose now that I have incoherent light, which scatters off an electron, but it's coming from every direction at the same temperature. So every time you scatter, you produce something polarized. The question is, what happens when you consider the effect of everything which scattered off? So let's consider just like an example in which you have, so it's the same thing as before. Suppose I look at light coming in this direction here. And suppose I have to consider light that comes from here and from there. So in this case, so this is my initial one, this is my initial two. So this guy here produces light polarizing this direction. This guy there produces light polarizing that direction. So although each one of these light rays scattering off the electron is producing polarized light, when I add this guy with this guy, because they have the same temperature, the final result is unpolarized, because it contains all the polarizations with the same intensity. So isotropic radiation does not produce polarization. Which means that it's great when I'm here, when I'm in the tight coupling regime, because I'm scattering things off. But the theta naught, which is the monopole, is seen in last scattering. So this thing basically gives me intensity in every single direction, gives me isotropic radiation. That does not produce a net polarization. The theta one, which is the dipole, is seen in the last scattering, so it's seen by the electrons, so it's the thing which gives me the velocity, also does not give me polarization, and it is a bit less intuitive. So a dipole would also not produce polarization. So this is a bit more complex to see, but maybe sketch this again. So in this case, let's imagine I have a dipole in this direction, in the direction X. So a dipole means that I have a higher temperature for photons coming from this direction. I have a lower temperature for photons coming from that direction. I have the average photons coming from there.
So let me look again at what happens in this direction, for example. So I look at the plane of polarization here. And it's the same thing. So basically, this guy has all, this guy is going to produce a Y polarization, which is stronger. So the polarization, by the way, is a vector without a head. It doesn't matter really in what way you're oscillating. It could be both ways. So although I'm putting the heads in the vectors, they're really headless. So this direction produces a stronger polarization in this direction, but this one produces a weaker polarization. And in this direction, I produce polarization or average in there. So the polarization I produce in this direction comes from here, and it's the average. And the polarization I produce in this direction is the average of these and that, which is this. So yet again, I don't produce a net polarization because, well, basically by symmetry. So every time I could produce an extra polarization, I have to balance it on the other side, and this average is to zero. So that pole also produces no polarization. I need to go to the quadrupole. So what I need is a quadrupole. I need to encase my electron by a quadrupolar field of radiation to get any polarization. And this is the lowest level in which I can produce polarization from scattering. So it's the same thing. Let me just do it here again. But in this case, a quadrupole means hot here, hot there, average there. And of course, in this case, I do produce more polarization in this direction. So these things are difficult to visualize. And you probably have to go home and play with them a little bit. This is general. This is a sketch in two directions, coming from two directions into one. But it's a more general thing that you can prove. So whenever you have something which is tightly coupled, you don't produce any radiation. Because in tightly coupled regime, this is zero. Quadrupole is zero. And the things which you usually call the density contrast and the velocity produce to that electron simply a monopole and a dipole. So this is isotropic radiation, this is a dipole, none of this produces polarization. Any questions about this? Was this clear or? When you're drawing things, you can see it. I'm not sure you're seeing it. So. So one thing that comes out of this immediately is that polarization is going to be small. Whatever you do, polarization is going to be like a second order effect, a very small thing. Because it occurs, basically you need two things. You need scattering, and you need viscosity, we need a quadrupole. So if you're in tight coupling, you have scattering, but you don't have the quadrupole. If you're free streaming, you have a quadrupole immediately. The modes start free streaming from 0 and 1 to 2, 3, 4, 5, and you see things up to 1,000 now. But then you don't have scattering. So it's essentially this intermediary regime in which you're about to decouple. That's the only point when you're going to produce polarization. So it's our window of opportunity for producing polarization, and it's going to be small necessarily. So a small window of opportunity. Any questions about this? I'm going to be giving you the results now. I'm not going to be doing the calculation. So doing the calculation means integrating the Boltzmann. There's no other way to do it. Okay, so what do we see in the sky? What exactly would be like polarization measures in the sky? So let me tell you first what happens in each direction, okay? And this is something which has been, it's kind of a formalism which has been set up in the 19th century, something called the Stokes parameters. And so what you do is, you're looking, for example, suppose I'm looking at light in the direction Z, suppose I look at the electric field, but there's obviously going to be transverse oscillations in the electric field, and the magnetic field is orthogonal to that. So we have an E, and let's suppose I look at EX and EY, which are the two possible transverse polarizations. These things are stochastic variables in incoherent light. Okay? So what you need to do is compute their average and a thing called the polarization tensor. So these I and j mean x and y. They are two-dimensional y's and j's. They're in the direction of orthogonal to the propagation direction. So the polarization tensor is the thing which qualifies completely this light ray is the average of EI, EJ. Which, if you ignore the fact that these things really are complex amplitudes, so if you ignore the phases, then you can write this in the following form: intensity plus Q, intensity minus Q, and U. So in other words, the intensity of the light ray is EX squared plus EY squared. And these two parameters, which I call the Stokes parameters, U, are EX squared minus EY squared, and V is the average of EX, EY. And I don't know if you've seen this, but this is essentially how we qualify the degree of polarization of light. I'm ignoring circle polarization, by the way. If you're taking the phases, there's an extra parameter there. Sorry, this is, I think I used the wrong one, Q and U is one. So this is Q, this is U. The other parameter V is actually the one that describes circle polarization. Sorry about that. So I don't know if you've seen this, but the typical way of describing this is, suppose I divide this thing with I, Q, U, and V. Suppose I divide these by the intensities. Then this thing fully qualifies what's happening with the polarization of light. If I get 1, 0, 0, 0, you have unpolarized light, because these things are zero, completely coherent, means there's no preferred EX, EY. If I have 1, plus or minus 1, 0, 0, I have linearly polarized light, like these for plus, like that for minus. So I prefer the EX or the EY, depending on whether plus 1 or minus 1. If I have 1, 0, 1, 0, then we're talking about, well, essentially these and these polarization degrees, plus or minus as well. And I've been ignoring it in those definitions because you don't find that in the microwave background. That's the only reason. But just for completeness, if I have 1, 0, 0, plus or minus 1, we're talking about left and counterclockwise and clockwise circular polarization. Have you seen this before? No one has seen this before. And the graduate courses are getting worse. To be honest, I had never had to use this until this became a big thing in CMB physics. I probably was taught this a long time ago. I can't remember much. Well, the next thing you probably have not seen, which is what happens if you try to project this on a sphere. So what I have is not, it's from one given direction, but what I have is a field. Right? I basically end up with a field of different polarization degrees in each direction, and I need to qualify this on a sphere. And that's a bit more complicated. And it's a bit more complicated because these Qs and Us and so on are not eigenmodes of the parity. So you need to do like a small transformation, which is like transforming something into an electric and a magnetic part, or transforming some field into a gradient of a scalar and a curl. It's exactly the same thing what I need to do here. We end up with eigenvectors of the parity and end up with something which doesn't depend on the way in which I orient my axis. So this is what I'm going to give you, and then I'll wrap up. We're going to finish a bit earlier today. And so what you do on a sphere is a field on the sphere of these various parameters. It gets more and more complicated. Even the calculation I did for just one plane wave in the last lecture is a mess. So try to visualize just one plane wave. What would be the various Z's, various Q's and U's that you would produce? It's an exercise, okay? And this is exactly what is going to be your exercise in this course out of these papers. So the way this is normally done is, instead of having, you have your PIJ, a polarization tensor, these Qs and Us are really their reliability. People used to use them. They will depend, if you try to put this on a sphere, they will depend on the way you orient the axis. So what you do is, you write these as a gradient of some scalar. And this is the problem, this thing is symmetric. So I need to symmetrize these. But this thing is trace-free as well, if I do not want to have intensity in there. So what this notation means, AB, is the symmetric bit minus. So it's 1/2 AB plus BA minus 1/2 GAB and then CC. I hope you understand it. Basically, what you have here is grad A grad B plus grad B grad A 1/2 minus 1/2 the metric Laplace. Okay? And why do I have the delta here? Because this is the covariant derivative on the sphere. So this is simple if I go to orthonormal coordinates, but in general, I can't do this everywhere. So I'll have to put like signs of thetas and whatever for the usual things, which give me the Petrarch components on the sphere. So this is the first term, and this is essentially the thing which represents the scalar bit before. Here we call it the electric part of the polarization. So this is not exactly the same level of discussion I have here. The level of discussion now is how these things distribute on the sphere, okay? S fields on the sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. AB.
Sorry, say it again.
AJ, IJ is AB or what?
Yeah. Someone is awake. Thanks. Okay, so this is the first bit. This is not very, very interesting, but it's actually, I need to give you this otherwise. What I'm going to say next doesn't make any sense. So this is actually how you define eventually various components of the polarization of the sphere as we see it in this guy. So this is the first bit. The second one is the equivalent of a curl. So you have an epsilon parameter, but it's going to be like this. So your epsilon only has two entries because it's on two dimensions. So it's around the sphere. And in this case, you basically use the same notation here to generate a curl. And this bit here is called magnetic polarization. So sometimes we talk about B modes, E modes, that's exactly what you're talking about in polarization. It's the curl bit and the electric bit. So second part of your exercise, gain intuition on what this is. So one thing which is important is actually, as I pointed out, the degree of... So another way to look at it, which is like the beginning of getting some kind of intuition into this. Suppose I have this quantity. So this thing is a vector, okay? So this is probably easier to define. But if you have, consider this vector, then you can say this is a pure grad for P, and this is a pure curl for P. So it's the same story as usual. So essentially, every time I have a vector field, I can compose it as a gradient of a scalar, as a solenoidal field. I can't do that with PAB because that's a tensor, but if I consider the grad, this one, this is a vector, and then I can do that. This is what I have. So this guy here is a scalar, and this guy here is a pseudo scalar. Okay? And this is very important. This is the reason why you do this transformation. The Qs and the Us and so on are not eigenmodes of the parity. So what you do, and this is exactly where I will make contact with observations in this area, what you do is the same thing I did with the temperature, but now in defining the C sub L for these things, I have to be very careful if I don't want to violate parity. So what you do is you talk about P, you look at, for example, PE as a function of N, and what I do is I expand these for some reasons which I won't go into, you need this free factor. And then you have PLM, YLM in the direction N. So it's exactly the same thing I did before with delta T, but now I do these with PE and PE.
And why do you want to preserve parity?
So people have written papers actually considering scenarios in which you violate parity, in which case you do. Basically, you don't need to do this in that case. That's the next thing I was going to say. Usually, every scenario I can think of, you preserve parity. So it's the same reason why you have isotropy. Why do I have isotropy? Actually, that's an observational issue, but most of cosmology is based on isotropy. It's the Copernican principle.
Oh,
so
the parity, like forward, backward?
Yeah. So not only don't want to have a direction in the sky which is preferred, but you don't want to have a preferred parity. So suppose, I mean, I know sugars have violate parity, but the universe is not sugar, right? So it's a different way of, I mean, it is an assumption. It's an assumption just like the Copernican principle. So there are models called the Bianchi models, for example, which violate isotropy, but not homogeneity. I could come up with models which violate parity, and people have done that. But if I take the simplest Friedman models, they're parity invariant as well.
But it is, we know that there is asymmetry between the north and south sky.
This is the I've worked on this, okay? So it's, I don't, people think, okay, I can tell you my gut feeling, I think it's a systematic error. So there's no doubt the data has these unusual things, the axis of field or whatever, these various crazy things. So it looks like the universe, it looks like the CMB has some evidence for violation of isotropy and parity. Okay, it looks like it. To my mind, it's a bit premature to say this is an intrinsically cosmological observation. And I spent like a year working on that. So it's possible that it's really real. If it's really real, but that means, well, that means you really are throwing out of the window all the basic Friedman cosmology, that's what it means. And it's just a different story altogether. But it, you know, this kind of big claims need a lot of proof. And I think in this case, it's, these things tend to be better for pinning down systematics more than anything else. So for example, the galaxy, for a galaxy, the galaxy is parity even. So if I find a preference for even parity in the sky, I know there must be some galactic remnant, some contamination. The things are odd, on the other hand, it means the opposite. It means it cannot be galactic. So there's no correlation with the galaxy. So this is interesting, really. It's interesting from the point of view of fundamental physics. So a very good question. Suppose the universe was intrinsically parity even, for example. Could you put the spinner field on it, for example? I mean, it would be quite complicated. There are several things which fundamental field theory issues, which would be completely different if the manifold on which you live is actually parity dependent, for example. So one thing is, for example, speaking of parity, so these guys here go like minus 1 to the L when you go into x minus x. So this is the parity of a given multiple. So this is what happens with the E. If I now do the same thing with the B, if I put the B in here, and I replace this guy with the BLM, then the BLM behaves exactly in the opposite way. So this is exactly the hallmark of of what happens with a vector and, well, basically a scalar and a pseudo-scalar. I start from a scalar and a pseudo-scalar. So the L equals 1 is a vector. When I change the axis, it gets a minus 1. The pseudo-vector gets a 1. So very good questions. And basically what we do now is the same way I had a power spectrum defined in this way. Remember, like first lecture. And this thing is actually called PP, but it's a temperature correlated. But now I can do exactly the same thing by putting here instead of the A's, I have the E's and the B's. So exactly with the same definitions. This comes from isotropy. But using the same definitions, I can have a CLB, a CLB. I can even have a CLTE. But unless I deliberately want to violate parity, I cannot have a CLTB or a CLDE, because this thing would be in the wrong parity. So come up with any model which violates parity, and yes, there will be a prediction, a non-vanishing CLTB and a CLDE. But in general, the spectra are related to compute. The electric bit, the magnetic bit, and if I want, a correlation between the temperature and the electric bit. So to my CLTT, I have now these extra three guys to compute. And this has been the challenge for the last few years, and will be for the next probably 10, 20 years, CMB observation. Now, why is this interesting? Well, this is the thing I will be leaving you, that this is serious as a problem. So if you really want to do a presentation, this is a good topic. You can pick anything about visualizing this, because it's probably better than formulae, but it's difficult to do. If you can find a nice way to visualize all these various statements I've made and illustrate it here, then already that's very good. But the next thing is what comes out of integrating the Boltzmann equation. And if you can find an intuitive way to understand that, that's a very good presentation. But let me just give you the result before showing the observations. So by physics here, I don't mean explaining anything. I just mean what comes out of the calculation using the Boltzmann equation. So try to find a physical intuition for why this is the case. I have a scalar mode, which means a density mode, then I only generate E polarization. If I have a gravity wave, which means a tensor mode, then I generate both E and B polarizations. So it's something you can convince yourself quite easily by looking at parity arguments. You can actually show, just using parity arguments, there's no way with a scalar mode I could generate a B mode, whereas with a tensor mode I could. If you can go back to the pictures I drew about scattering electrons, and imagine a plane wave, which is, first of all, a plane wave that's a gravity wave, and a plane wave which is a density wave. If you could find a way of intuitively understanding this, then it would be very interesting. Okay? Can be done, but it's something you have to think about, visualize, and try to explain with pictures. But this is anyway what comes out of the Boltzmann equation. I could have done that as well, just algebraically go through the whole thing. The amplitudes of these things are very small, because essentially what you need is compute this quadrupole Eblas scattering, and what you find is that this thing, well, this thing is suppressed, and surprisingly, by this tau minus 1. So remember, a tau is the thing which goes to 0 as soon as you decouple, but it's actually infinite in type coupling. You cannot decouple, otherwise you don't have scattering. But then the problem is that if you have scattering, this thing is very large. So this figure 2 is always very small. Polarization is always very small. But what comes out of the Boltzmann equation is actually the term which gives you the Doppler term is exactly the thing which also gives you the theta 2, but much smaller. So there's this density fluctuation, there's a Doppler effect. That velocity is the thing which the leading order term produces a quadrupole that lasts scattering, which in turn produces your E-mode polarization. And this thing peaks at around 1,000, which is also the scale where the silk damping starts. So I think I have a few pictures here of this. There you are. This is very good. So what you can see here is what a typical scalar mode and a typical tensor mode does. This is a temperature. We computed this. And what this is the TE and E for a scalar mode. And this thing peaks as you go exactly into the scales at which you're suppressing the temperature. Because the same thing which is diffusing the photons, therefore suppressing the fluctuations, silk-damping everything. So the thing which is essentially a breaking down type coupling, the thing which generates polarization. And this is what you see there. If you look at the tensor mode, then of course what happens is that there is a much smaller TT which gets suppressed. That's one thing you could already see in the film I showed you earlier on. It also produces TE, but now produces a B and the E, and these guys are comparable. Scale is different, so one more thing to say. In case of tensors, it's a different story. Basically, the theta 2 for tensors goes like tau dot minus 1 hij dot. You have a B and an E, but now the scale is going to be around 100 because gravity waves get suppressed inside the horizon. So the same scale which gives you the first peak in the temperature, which is the horizon scale at mass scattering, is the scale at which you start suppressing gravity waves. And therefore you suppress these B and these E modes produced by tensor modes. And this is essentially what the calculations are. So every time in inflation, you predict something for tensor, in this case is actually probably I've seen this tensor to scale ratio. You make a prediction for what you should see in the temperature and what you should see in various polarization nodes. So this is great. It's great because I don't know what your feeling about inflation is, but my feeling is that it's not really a predictive theory. You can predict anything you want until you bring in the tensor mode. There's a relation between tensor modes and scalar modes, which is, at least if you don't complicate and go into multi-field inflation, is very well defined and predicted. So things like what is the spectral index and scalar and so on, you can fudge anything you want, to be honest. But unless you go into multi-field inflation, you really have a very strong relation between these, which is the scalar mode and the tensor mode. So if you put pin down this guy with the temperature, you can't really, because it's too much degeneracy. But if you could find the B here and measure these, then you'd be proving inflation, I think, or disproving inflation. Well, people would always say, yeah, then it's multi-field inflation. Yeah. I think it would be time to throw in the towel for them if you actually could violate this relation. More to the point, detecting gravity waves is a major thing. We're not going to see the graviton. That's too much. The graviton is obviously the thing which should tell you something about quantum gravity or not, but even just seeing a classical wave, a gravity wave, would be a major achievement. And this would be a very nice way to see it. So there's all these very complex experiments out there trying to detect gravity waves on the scale of very small scales, so inside the solar system. These gravity waves are much bigger, they're on cosmological scales, okay? But there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to see them first here. But the challenge there really is to find the B mode polarization. It's not easy, and the reason is the following. The reason is that, unfortunately, this is one thing I was going to show you, but I won't. Fortunately, what happens is that the foreground, particularly the synchrotron foreground, is extremely polarized. If you look at the foregrounds in general, and it could be things like starlight, whatever, all kinds of things are polarized, you actually generate all kinds of polarization. E-mode polarization, B-mode polarization, circle polarization, by the way, which doesn't appear here. You even generate these guys, because of course you violate parity when you look at the galaxy or at the stars around you. So by looking at circular polarization or these kind of polarizations, I can monitor what is out there in terms of foregrounds. And the picture, which is a very nice picture I showed you for the temperature, in this big window at 90 gigahertz, where everything is dominated by the CMB, that picture is simply not valid for these foregrounds, for polarization. Typically, the polarization of the foregrounds is 10 times bigger than the CMB polarization. If you go into B mode, it could be 100 times bigger. So we're talking about not removing this nasty noise, but looking at things which are dominated by noise and try to dig up the signal. These things are not thermal, that's good. So if I look at different frequencies, perhaps I should be able to take out this residual, which is the CMB polarization. And it's going to be a much more complicated task. So while I think it's great to detect B-mode polarization, it would be something which would be a much more doable way of detecting gravity waves, I think there's a lot of work to do. This is another example of what could happen. For example, the masks people use. So these are the regions in the sky which are completely useless. There's no way you're going to find in these areas. And there's different ways of doing it. But even if I am really, really tolerant
about the errors and everything, I have to throw away most of this guy. And then, so this is really quite a problem. And I think the attitude now, if you talk to experimentalists, is no longer one of saying we're going to be able to do all these things within 10 years or something. I think the attitude is more like one of cautious optimism. So in the past, every time we were worried about foregrounds or whatever, things have turned out better than what we expected. No one thought the WMAP would actually measure the third peak, for example, and they did. They managed to dig into the beam and actually find this third peak. With polarization, well, maybe it will be better than what we think. But indications so far are exactly that it's going to be a really tough job. Let me just show you a couple of things. So this is what came out of WMAP 3. This is WMAP 1, that's WMAP 3, one side and the other. So what you can see is obviously that there were all these issues here with the third peak, and now the third peak has been detected. There was a big problem here, that EE, at some point, had this big bump here. So if there is reionization, one thing that happens is that not only you smooth the temperature, but then you have a chance to generate more polarization, because you rescatter things, there's more, basically it's the same game that generates polarization at last scattering, but much more recently, which means much bigger angular scales. So when WMAP 1 came out, people just said, oh, we found evidence for reionization. But this is WMAP 3 disappeared. So what happened here, this is a good lesson. Basically, they found that this thing was mainly foregrounds. And people have become much more cautious about foregrounds. So the models they were using for foregrounds were really a bit too optimistic. And by reanalyzing the thing, again, all that stuff has disappeared from first to third year. So it's not just reducing error bars. We're talking about systematic errors being corrected. And this is where we stand at the moment. So what this is temperature, TE. And now they found actually the EE. This is the B, we haven't got it yet. And this is where we stand at the moment with WMAP 3. So I'll stop here. And one thing you may want to do as a problem, as I said, is try and find intuition for this black hole. And rather than just go to Donaldson, which is the reference for this, rather than just go there and go through the calculation, which is a Boltzmann equation solution, to derive these results, try and find some intuition for why is it that tensor modes give you E and depolarization. Okay, thank you.